Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 7th of January, these are our main stories. Forces loyal to Libyan warlord General Khalifa Haftar say they've taken control of areas around the city of Sirte. Amid rising tensions between the US and Iran, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on world leaders to show restraint. Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein charged with sexual assault in Los Angeles on the day his rape trial begins in New York. Also in this podcast,
you got the kangaroo island, kangaroo, tamar wallaby, southern brown bandicoot, pygmy possums, curlews, ringtail possums, the platypus, glossy black cockatoos.
There's concern for the lives of many animals in Kangaroo Island off the coast of South Australia after bushfires swept across part of it over the weekend. We begin in Libya, and the forces of the warlord General Khalifa Haftar say they've stormed and captured the coastal city of Sirte, which up to now had been in the hands of the country's UN-backed government. General Haftar's forces hold much of Libya, but several key cities, including the capital Tripoli, have remained beyond his control. Speaking in Benghazi, the spokesman for General Haftar's self-styled Libyan National Army, Ahmed al-Mismari, said it had been a long-held aim to capture Sirte.
The High Command of the Libyan National Army officially announces the liberation and purification of the city of Sirte from terrorism and from criminals. We have always thought of the city of Sirte, which is dear to our hearts. We have always made military plans for it, but have always postponed these plans so that Sirte wouldn't fall prey to the clashes.
The general recently intensified his efforts to gain ground as Turkey prepares to ramp up its military support for the beleaguered government. I spoke to our Middle East analyst Alan Johnson and asked him for more details on the situation in Sirte.
Well, what's happened has been pretty dramatic and pretty unexpected. We didn't really see this coming. Apparently, this assault began with a wave of airstrikes that would have softened up the city's defences. Soon we were hearing about outlying areas being captured and airport being seized, and then a fast thrust into the heart of Sirte, and residents there telling the Reuters news agency at one point that they had seen convoys of attacking troops in the centre of the city. This all happening in a matter of hours. Suggestions that perhaps there was some sort of defection in the ranks of those defending Sirte.
I mentioned that Sirte is important for the oil refining business in Libya. Is it significant to fall into the hands of a warlord like General Haftar?
Well, General Haftar, as I think you said, holds much of Libya, but he doesn't have a string of important cities on the coast, including, most importantly of all, the capital, Tripoli. He's been trying to capture Tripoli for months now and made little progress. But suddenly he has this breakthrough in another city, in Sirte, and it is important. As you say, it has a port and it's very close to what they call the oil crescent, which is the backbone of Libya's wealth and economy. And suddenly you feel that General Haftar's campaign has fresh momentum. His opponents will be dismayed by this development.
How will this affect Turkey's plans to kind of ramp up its presence in the area?
Well, General Haftar has attracted significant foreign support from the likes of the Egyptians, the United Arab Emirates. He's said to have Russian mercenaries helping him. But Turkey has backed the other side in the conflict. Turkey has backed the government and says it's going to send it more troops and support. And as the Turks watch what's happened so quickly in Sirte, they may well feel they need to step up, accelerate their effort to help the government before it loses any more ground.
Alan Johnson there. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said the tensions in the world are at their highest level this century. He made no direct reference to the US airstrike that killed the Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq, but Mr. Guterres went on to say,
"The new year has begun with our world in turmoil. We are living in dangerous times. Geopolitical tensions are at their highest level this century, and this turbulence is escalating. even nuclear non-proliferation can no longer be taken for granted. This cauldron of tensions is leading more and more countries to take unpredicted decisions with unpredictable consequences and the profound risk of miscalculation.
The Iranian general Qasem Soleimani is being buried on Tuesday in his home city Kerman in the south of Iran. On Monday, millions of mourners filled central Tehran to witness the cortege, with the grief-stricken throwing their scarves onto the coffin and chanting "Death to America." Iran's leaders have sworn to avenge his killing. From Baghdad in the neighbouring Iraq, our Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen sent this report on Monday's events.
The broad avenues of the Iranian capital were jammed with mourners. The crowd was estimated in millions. Not all Iranians are as distressed about General Qasem Soleimani's death. He was a hardliner, a dominant force in a regime that shot dead hundreds of protesters on Iran's streets at the end of 2019. But at the funeral ceremony in Tehran, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, looked rattled by the shock of the assassination of a vital right-hand man. The Ayatollah led the prayers for the dead over the coffin, his voice breaking with emotion. Around him, other bearded, turbaned clerics were weeping. Qasem Soleimani's daughter, Zainab, delivered a fiery oration, demanding revenge for the father she called a martyr. "Don't think," she said, "that this is the end of it." Donald Trump, she said, was crazy, a Zionist plaything. The families of American soldiers would be spending their days waiting for news of the deaths of their children. Here in Baghdad, where Soleimani was killed, his allies from Iraq's Shia militias and political parties, including the former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, gathered for an official mourning ceremony at a mosque protected by lines of heavily armed elite Iraqi troops.
A big poster of Donald Trump with a red cross across its face has been put onto the ground where everybody can walk over it, driving over it too, a sign of disrespect, hatred and anger. There's a lot of that here.
At the mosque, their anger was held in check. Their fury was mostly quiet. But the desire for revenge was everywhere, in faces, chants and conversation, and will not dissipate easily.
Jeremy Bowen in Baghdad. Since news emerged of the drone strike that killed General Soleimani, leaders in the US and Iran have exchanged threatening rhetoric. President Trump said that if Iran took military action against the US, he might order attacks on Iranian cultural sites, which could constitute a war crime under international law. Razia Iqbal spoke to Atarollah Mojarani, a former Iranian minister for culture and Islamic guidance, about what he understood to be an Iranian cultural site.
It is, I think, so difficult to define exactly what is the cultural site. For instance, Isfahan is a cultural site.
The entire city of Isfahan.
The entire city of Isfahan. I remember one of the great poet of Iraqis, Abdul Wahab Bayati, when he's talking with his beloved one, says, "Your eyes are Isfahan." It means Isfahan is a cultural site. Who can destroy the one city like Isfahan? Shiraz is a cultural site. Shiraz is the capital of ancient Iran. Isfahan is the capital of Islamic Iran. And also the city is full of cultural sites. Come back to the martyrdom of Qasem Soleimani. Qasem Soleimani was a cultural site. And President Trump killed and destroyed this cultural site. But he was like a bottle, a glass of perfume. When it was broken, so we are witnessing the stream of smelling of perfume in the world.
You are part of what could be described as the reformist elements of Iran, the liberal wing of Iranian politics. And I wonder why then you speak about General Soleimani in this way, because there are many people, including those people who targeted him in the United States, who feel that this man has blood on his hands, he's a murderer.
I think rarely people believing like this, rarely. When you look at Iran, how for instance, we can judge and justify like this, for instance, judgment about Qasem Soleimani, when less, for instance, millions of people coming to participate in his funeral. I know Qasem Soleimani very well, more than 40 years. When I was young, I was in the first period of parliament in Iran. I was in the defense committee. And so Qasem Soleimani was a young man in Revolutionary Guard. I was a young person in the Majlis, for instance, the minister of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the ex-minister of Shah, Ardashir Zahedi. He was the minister of foreign affairs in the time of Shah, and also he was the son-in-law of Shah. He says we can compare General Soleimani with De Gaulle, with Eisenhower, with Marshal Rommel. He was Qasem Soleimani. Also, I'd like to add, who stopped the Daesh and ISIS in Syria and in Iraq and in Lebanon? Who stopped? Qasem Soleimani.
Atarallah Moharjerani, Iran's former culture minister. Now to other news. New sex crime charges have been filed against the former Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein in Los Angeles on the same day that his high-profile rape trial got underway in New York. The film producer has repeatedly denied accusations of sexual misconduct by dozens of women, many of them actresses. He has pleaded not guilty to charges of rape and sexual assault in the New York case. Mr. Weinstein ignored heckles from protesters gathered outside the Manhattan courthouse as he arrived for the start of the trial there on Monday. I spoke to the BBC's Neda Tawfik, who was there.
He arrived at the courthouse here with a walker with the aid of his attorneys, and inside and outside it was an emotional start to this trial. The defense and prosecution argued about pretrial matters, including photos of Harvey Weinstein, sensitive photos that the prosecution wants introduced as evidence and the defense was arguing against. Now, they've actually adjourned for the day and jury selection will begin. They will have to screen through thousands of people to pick just 12 jurors and 6 alternates, a process that could take up to 2 weeks, and then the trial after that is expected to take anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks. So we're looking at months here for this trial. But as I say, it was an emotional start because besides the fact that Harvey Weinstein could face life in prison if he is convicted, this is obviously a very pivotal, important moment in the lives of his accusers. There are 2 women in this case, but some other accusers who aren't a part of it were here outside of court to speak their piece. You had those like Rosanna Arquette, Rose McGowan, speaking to the press, saying that they were here to give a voice to the voiceless, to stand in solidarity with the women who were testifying, and that they see this as a victory. Even though they don't know what the outcome will be, they said they do see this as a victory, and they do think this is important to show women that if they speak up, they can see results.
Yeah, this case will be watched by everyone in the entertainment business, and it could have far-reaching consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important to remember that Harvey Weinstein, his downfall, sparked the Me Too movement, a global movement that didn't just affect Hollywood, but it affected politics and media. And many are looking at this case to see if the criminal justice system has really changed enough, because notoriously, sexual assault cases have been the hardest to prosecute. You know, when you look at prosecutors across the country, they've also been pretty reluctant to take them on unless they were a pretty solid case and not a he said, she said case. That's one of the reasons they're so hard to prosecute. So here, many are looking to see if there has been any real change in the criminal justice system. And on that note, I think it's just important to point out the fact that also in Los Angeles today, Harvey Weinstein has been charged with 2 counts, criminal counts of sexual assault involving 2 women in 2013, 1 of forcible rape and 1 of sexual assault. These are in Los Angeles, and the district attorney there said that once this case is done in New York, he will have to go to Los Angeles to stand trial there, and there he faces 28 years in prison. So certainly just the start of Harvey Weinstein's legal troubles.
And that's Neda Tawfik in New York. Now news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
For teenagers like me, it's hard to imagine a world where the tech we take for granted didn't exist.
We didn't have email back then. You know, everything was mail, or we didn't have internet.
So in our new podcast, Worldwise Web, 12 of us from around the world will be spending time with the people who invented it.
We believed someday everybody would have a cell phone.
Finding out how they came up with their ideas.
I'm always saying yes to the weirdest of things just so I can find all those crazy things in life that are really fun.
And asking for advice. advice.
You've got to figure out what drives you. What makes you really happy? Do that.
That's World Wise Web from the BBC World Service.
You have conducted probably one of the greatest interviews I've ever had.
To hear more about it, search for World Wise Web wherever you get your podcasts.
Wow, okay, we are in a new world.
And look out for the first episode on the 10th of January.
Okay, bye. Thank you very much.
Now back to this podcast. Light rain and cooler temperatures have brought some relief to parts of Australia ravaged by severe bushfires. But the authorities are warning that hotter weather later in the week could reignite some blazes. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to leave their homes. At least 24 people have died since the fires started in September. This report is from our correspondent Jonathan Head, who's been to some of the worst affected areas in the state of New South Wales.
A cool break over the past 24 hours in the hot, dry weather has helped firefighters battling the more than 150 bushfires that are still burning in southeastern Australia. Many of the thousands who had to evacuate towns over the weekend have been able to return, some to the relief of finding their homes untouched by the flames, others to the despair of charred ruins. "We keep hearing the word unprecedented," said one woman standing in front of what was left of her house. "But this is unprecedented. We've never seen anything like it before." The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, who's been criticised for his slow response to the disaster, has now mobilised army reservists to help get relief to the affected communities. He's also announced a national bushfire recovery fund to finance reconstruction. But his government's reluctance to accept a link between global warming and the severity of this year's fires and the apparent failure to anticipate this crisis has damaged his political standing. Meteorologists are warning that hotter weather will return in just a few days, with the likelihood that the fires will then resume their destructive path.
Jonathan Head. Over the weekend, the bushfires swept across the western half of Kangaroo Island, just off the coast of South Australia. It's feared that half of the island's koala population and other endangered species could be wiped out. Divya Arya spoke to Sam Mitchell, the co-owner of Kangaroo Island Wildlife Park.
So I have a wildlife park here, which has been caring for Australian natives for many years now, and my house is on site. Just out the back of my house is where the area for the burn victims has been built. We were never prepared to take on such a large amount of animals. We've always been able to deal with, you know, 5 to 10 or 20 maximum, when now we're seeing 20 show up at a time. So I'm just sitting down near the kitchen and bottle feeding these guys, treating some of their wounds, and yeah, still a long way to go yet. We've got six of the orphan koalas, two orphan kangaroos inside the house, just so we can monitor their temperature a little bit better, and they all require vet treatment and bottle feeding, so just sitting here working through them. And the number keeps changing, so we've got four next to me, one on me, one in front of me, and two more in pouches.
It must be distressing to see the animals suffer like this.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of animals come in that don't stand a chance. You know, it's pretty bad when their nails are completely burnt off. You know, we've got people running through our doors hysterical with kangaroos wrapped up. And unfortunately, you know, there's nothing we can do for them. We're saving what we can, but some of these guys are suffering from severe lung damage. You know, they'll be blind because their eyes have just taken in too much smoke and heat. Some animals don't make it out of the cars. You know, people have picked them up off the side of the road and bring them here, and it's just too much for them. But, you know, we've got a good number that we'll pull through. But, again, it's only early days. We'll see animals for the next few weeks. There's a lot out there that may not have suffered any injuries, but they will now start dying of starvation because, yeah, the food source has been completely wiped out. From what I'm aware, about 155,000 hectares of the island, which is one-third of the island, has now burnt quite severely. And a lot of businesses, homes, we've lost lives. And, of course, the animals are suffering along with it.
One of the estimates I heard was that half the koala population there has been decimated. Is that true?
Yeah, and we can't confirm these numbers because, you know, it's only early days, but the western end of the island was prime koala habitat. Like I said, a third of the island has burnt, and the eastern end of the island didn't hold as many koalas. So, you know, we've seen people out on the grounds that are trying to save as many burn victims as they can, and the numbers that we're hearing are to every animal they see alive, or every koala that's alive, you'll see 100 dead. And there are some areas where the animals just didn't stand a chance. The fires were too hot, so everything perished with it.
And it's not just the koalas, though they are the ones you're nursing yourself at the moment, but other species as well that have been affected in the wildlife park?
Yeah, so other than that, you got the Kangaroo Island kangaroo, tamar wallaby, southern brown bandicoot, pygmy possums, curlews, ringtail possums, the platypus, glossy black cockatoos. Yeah, the Kangaroo Island dunnart was quite a unique species. There was only about somewhere between 300 to 500 of those guys left. I can't remember the exact number, and their habitat's right in the centre where the fires were, so there's not much hope for them.
And from forecasts, it seems that there's been a small respite with the rain, but the heat will rise again. Is there anything that can be done to save wildlife, knowing that the bushfires can return or can flare up again?
I mean, not really at the moment. It's like I said, there's still fires burning. There's people that have lost their houses, and some farms have lost, you know, tens of thousands of animals. So, I mean, I don't know. Our main focus is focusing on the animals that are coming through our doors at the moment. We don't even have time to do your ordinary day things. We've been running flat out. So, yeah, I've got no idea what's going to happen in the next few weeks.
Sam Mitchell there, the co-owner of Kangaroo Island Wildlife Park in South Australia. Beijing's new top official in Hong Kong, who made his name enforcing party discipline in mainland China, has urged the territory to return to what he called the right path. Lo Hai-ning's appointment is the first major change in political leadership in Hong Kong since pro-democracy protests began 7 months ago. His appointment was announced 3 days ago and comes after reports that the Chinese government was dissatisfied with his predecessor's handling of the crisis. Our correspondent Stephen McDonald reports from Beijing.
When activists besieged the Chinese government's headquarters in Hong Kong 5 months ago, it would have sent shockwaves through the Politburo Standing Committee back in Beijing. Protesters covered the walls in graffiti, some calling President Xi Jinping a dog. That their representative in Hong Kong didn't foresee what was going to happen just outside his own office window meant that Wang Jumin's days were numbered. In fact, the resilient nature of the protest movement, the size of its community support, the ability of pro-democracy demonstrators to change tack, all seemed to have come as a surprise to a Chinese leadership which hates surprises. So they've brought in a new man to oversee the troubled city. Luo Huining was the Communist Party secretary in Qinghai, a province where ethnic Tibetans have been on the receiving end of a tough crackdown. And then in Shanxi, he oversaw a purge of senior party officials accused of corruption. Today was his first day as head of the powerful Central Liaison Office in Hong Kong, and he spoke to reporters without taking questions. For half a year, the situation has been worrying, he said, adding that everyone eagerly hopes the city can return to the right path. Then he quoted President Xi, saying that without harmony, without a stable environment, there'd be no home with peace and contentment. The 65-year-old has little experience with Hong Kong affairs, but is a loyal servant of the party who's shown a preparedness to come down hard on its enemies if that's what's asked of him.
Stephen McDonald in China. To Ireland now, where more than 10 years after the financial crash and despite an extraordinary economic turnaround, the country is in the throes of a severe housing crisis. A lack of housing stock and increased immigration have tightened supply, and with rents at an all-time high, many people have been priced out of the market altogether. Traditionally, families in financial trouble would have approached their local council to be put on a list for cheaper social housing subsidised by the state. But with thousands on the lists, for many, the prospect of a home appears bleak. Helen Devlin has been to the Irish capital, Dublin, to investigate.
Messy, as kids do. I thought at one stage I was letting my kids down. The state is letting my kids down. They just don't care at the minute.
Anita is angry. The 33-year-old mother of three has been living in a homeless hostel in North Dublin since she was evicted from her rental home. Unable to afford to rent another property, she turned to a housing charity for support. And while her family now have a roof over their heads, the continuing uncertainty is having a devastating impact.
My eldest child has recently been suffering with mental health issues. She's having thoughts of self-harm and all, which is horrific. My daughter, who's having syndrome, her anxiety is hitting the roof at the minute. She's actually picking her fingers. She'll sit there as soon as she comes in the door and she's picking at her fingers and her skin and all.
Anita's family are far from alone. 3,500 children are currently homeless in Ireland. A lack of social housing stock and record rents have pushed many young families into homelessness. One woman who knows all about the crisis is Dublin County Councillor Carly Bailey.
We're chock-a-block. We have an office downstairs. It's a homeless office and it's always full. Standing room only most mornings.
Carly herself was made homeless twice in the last few years and now spends her time dealing with the daily realities of the housing crisis.
The situation really is it's awful. It's genuinely so, so bad. In our particular area, say Dublin County Council, for example, there's over 6,500 people on a social housing list. For the vast majority of those, they're going to be on that list for 12 years or more. And when all we hear constantly as an excuse from this, that these things take time, they've had years and we're still not seeing any movement.
What do we want?
Hope for all!
What do we want?
Yeah! The City Council has called on the government to declare a state of emergency in relation to the
what
housing.
What can be done to solve Ireland's housing crisis? Rising rents, record.
It's hard to escape the impact the housing crisis is having in Ireland. It's part of daily conversations, political campaigns and even street protests. Much of the anger is being directed towards the government and its policies, but also towards companies like Airbnb and institutional landlords who bought or built thousands of units in the last few years, paying little or nothing in Irish tax while openly speaking about charging the highest possible rent. And while companies like Airbnb no doubt further restrict an already limited housing supply, it's not the only factor at play. Dr. Lorcan Sir is a lecturer in housing studies at Technological University Dublin.
Most of the solutions are relying on the private sector to provide a solution for the state. And a good example of that is people who turn up to their local authority asking to be housed. And there are no council or local authority houses for them to go into. So they are increasingly being put into the private rental sector.
While there's no one cause to the housing crisis, the man charged with solving it is the Minister for Housing, Owen Murphy. I've come to government buildings in the centre of Dublin to meet him.
The root of all of this thing, if we want to talk about people in emergency accommodation, if we want to talk about people paying too high a rent, if we're not supplying enough homes, we're not going to be able to address those other measures. And what we see now today, in line with our targets, will bring about approximately about 25,000 new homes to live in. But there continues to be pressures around things like rent because we continue to still have an undersupply of housing. But added to that, we had new demand coming into the country. And that's increased the pressures that we've been facing.
While the government continues to try and solve the housing crisis, for families like Anita's, a resolution can't come soon enough.
There's not a day I grow up and say, right, today is going to be a good day, because I can't. I don't feel comfortable in the sense that I'm going to be all right here. I just don't know what tomorrow's going to bring.
That was Anita ending that report by Helen Devlin in Dublin. Here in Britain, a well-known fast food chain brought in a new meat-free burger on Monday, but the move was not welcomed by vegetarians because they can't eat it. Burger King's new Rebel Whopper is cooked on the same grill as its meat patties. The company says it's aimed at people who want to cut down on their meat consumption but haven't given up altogether. Here's our business reporter, Laura Jones.
Following recent vegan product launches by Greggs, Costa and Subway, Burger King announced a soy-based version of its Whopper burger would be available in its restaurants. But the fast food chain has admitted it's not suitable for vegans because it's cooked on the same grill as its meat burgers. The plant-based Whopper will also be served with mayonnaise unless customers ask otherwise. Burger King did reassure BBC News that its bean burger and its veggie kids burger are cooked separately. It also said that the burger was actually aimed at those trying to cut down on their meat consumption, or flexitarians. Edward Bergen, a food and drinks analyst at the research firm Mintel, says it's not vegans driving the demand for plant-based food, as they only make up 1 or 2% of the population, but changing diets.
we've got more than half of UK consumers that are actively reducing their meat consumption. And all it takes for them is just one or two meals a week that they used to have meat, and they're switching out and having plant-based foods, vegan dishes that they may not have tried before. And that's where those big sales are coming from.
The Vegan Society called the launch a missed opportunity and said that vegan mayonnaise is widely available and already being used by other big chains.
Laura Jones, and that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Joe Lynham. Until next time, goodbye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.